This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Every 4th of July, Americans remember Benjamin Franklin's contributions as a statesman and a wordsmith, helping Thomas Jefferson craft that immortal phrase, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." But Franklin was also a tinkerer and a world-class scientist, and he had a passion for sound. Did you know that Franklin invented his own musical instrument? Dennis James does. He's professor of glass musical studies. Yes, that's glass music studies at Mason Gross School of Arts at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And last year, he introduced us to Ben Franklin's own homespun music machine, the glass harmonica. Can you describe this instrument for us?
Well, it's a version, improvement of the musical glasses. If you've ever irritated people at dinner by picking up your wine glass, wetting your finger and rubbing the rim, that's the principle. But Franklin saw a player named Delaval play in 1761 in March in Cambridge. Franklin was representing the Pennsylvania colony at court in London at the time. And he was a member of the Royal Society, and Edmund Delaval played a table of individual wine glasses mounted. And Franklin wrote in his diary that right after seeing that he thought that he was charmed by the sweetness of the notes, but the music, he wished to see the glasses disposed in a more convenient form, brought together in a narrow compass so as to admit a greater number of tunes, all within the reach of a hand of a person seated before the instrument. So what he did is he commissioned some special glasses that didn't have stems, simply the bowl, put a hole where the bowl was, where the back of the bowl, so that he could put a metal shaft and had them cupped together, sort of like an Indian bell tree, and so that they were all nested together in a horizontal row with just the rims showing, and then you'd wet your fingers, put them in array, sort of like a keyboard. You're just touching the rims. They're turning horizontally underneath. He put a mechanism to make the whole thing turn like a sewing machine mechanism. And the result was such an improvement that it's now classified the first American musical instrument.
Wow. And we have a little bit from your album about what that sounded like. Tell us a bit about this as we listen a little.
This is the most famous work, most famous because if we didn't have it, you wouldn't hear of the instrument today. It was written by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and it's a little adagio in C that he wrote for the major player of the instrument, Mariner Kerkesner, the blind player, reigning virtuosa of the day. And she would play this piece to introduce people to the sound of the instrument, and then she followed it with a companion work Mozart wrote for her with a chamber ensemble. And so the two were matching works, but this single, it's considered one of the most exquisite and charming small pieces that Mozart ever wrote. Just gorgeous.
So there were a lot of people playing this instrument then.
Well, we know that one factory alone in northern France made 5,000 of them in the days when the instrument was popular. Franklin himself commissioned 8 of them, which he distributed. He gave one to his mistress, Madame Brion, outside of Paris, and he gave one to his daughter, Sally. And so there were 8 of Franklin's own, and the original Franklin instrument does survive, and it's sitting in the showcase at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia.
Let's hear a little more of it here. Well, we can never look at a wine glass the same way again after this.
Play them. Just play them.
Thank you very much, Dennis, for joining us today. Dennis James is professor of glass music studies at Mason Gross School of Arts at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And you can see him playing a glass harmonica on our website at sciencefriday.com. Now, Franklin wasn't just interested in new ways to make sounds. He also wanted to learn how to measure them. Even before that famous lightning storm, Franklin was working on another experiment, testing the loudness of the human voice. Well, one human voice in particular, George Whitefield. He was an English priest. He claimed that he could preach to 80,000 people at once, way before there were microphones. Franklin, being a guy who dealt in data, wasn't buying it, without a test. So when Whitfield visited Philadelphia in 1739, Franklin decided to run a little experiment to find out just how loud Whitfield really was. Over 270 years later, another sound specialist, Braxton Boren, thinks he's found a way to test whether Ben's estimate was right. Braxton is a PhD candidate at New York University's Music and Audio Research Lab, and he reconstructed Franklin's voice experiment using some modern-day tools. His first step? Recreate the ambiance of 18th century Philly. How many people could have heard Whitfield depended on how noisy the place was. So Braxton had to figure out what Philly used to sound like.
So this is the sound of a horse-drawn carriage on gravel.
A sound common in Philadelphia and one that Braxton needed for his recreation.
Actually, I went to Central Park, and there are lots of horse-drawn carriages that go around the Cherry Hill Fountain, which has gravel all around it. So while these guides were taking their tourists around and giving them interesting facts, I was running along the side of them at a fixed distance and measuring their sound pressure levels.
This was not Braxton's first time tracking down historical sounds. Before chasing after horses in Central Park, he helped historians simulate the acoustics of Renaissance churches. So, when he read about Franklin's Whitfield experiment, Braxton thought maybe he could pick up where Franklin left off.
The more I began to think about it, you know, with the tools we have and the computational power, it was very straightforward as to how you would update using the data that Franklin recorded into a modern computer model to sort of finish the experiment as I would think that Franklin might want to finish it today if he were around.
So, how did Franklin test the reach of Whitfield's voice? Well, just the way you would expect him to. He went to hear Whitfield speak when the preacher came to Philadelphia and recounted it in his autobiography.
He preached one evening from the top of the courthouse steps, which are in the middle of Market Street, and on the west side of the Second Street, which crosses it at right angles. Both streets were filled with his hearers to a considerable distance. Being amongst the hindmost in Market Street, I had the curiosity to learn how far he could be heard by retiring backwards down the streets towards the river. And I found his voice distinct till I came near Front Street, when some noise in that street obscured it.
Standing on Front Street, now out of range of Whitfield's voice, Franklin made a back-of-the-envelope calculation. He started with the distance between himself and Whitfield.
So he said, if I use that value as a radius and I calculate the area of a semicircle, then I'll know the area in which people could definitely hear him, assuming they have the same hearing as I do. And then he tried to figure out how many people he could fit into that.
That gave Franklin a ballpark estimate.
After he did all that, he thought that 30,000 was reasonable.
This reconciled me to the newspaper accounts of his having preached to 25,000 people in the fields, and to the ancient histories of generals haranguing whole armies, of which I had sometimes doubted.
So Franklin thought Whitfield could maybe reach 30,000 people. But how accurate was he? That's what Braxton wanted to know. He decides to build a computer model of 18th century Philadelphia to test Ben's estimate. He knows about background noise. He's mapped out the buildings around Whitfield, researched what they're made of, and he has Franklin's estimate for the distance where Whitfield's voice became too soft to understand. He calls this the minimum cusp of intelligibility.
We could work backwards and say, how loud would someone speaking at Whitfield's point have had to have been in order to be at this minimum cusp of intelligibility at Franklin's position?
It turns out Whitfield was really loud, 16 decibels higher than the international standard for loud speech. Whitfield was so loud, Braxton started second-guessing his own results.
I wasn't sure if I'd made a mistake or if this was even possible, so I did a series of experiments, actually, with trained opera singers and actors who are used to speaking without amplification at very high levels. And in fact, across the board, the top value that they reached was 90 decibels, which is the same that we were projecting for Whitfield.
George Whitfield's voice could get this loud. 90 decibels, 90. Ooh, that's better.
So it showed that it is possible. It's just sort of a lost art for the most part, because most of us are sort of used to microphones and we don't have any occasion to raise our voices to such a level these days. But among trained vocalists, it is still possible.
Now that he knows how Whitfield sounded in Philly, Braxton does something Franklin could not. He tests out the preacher's powerful voice on his home turf in London. Braxton builds computer models of the three sites in London where Whitfield had his largest crowds. And he makes one adjustment to Franklin's calculations.
I looked into a lot of crowd estimation techniques that people use today, and across the board, people pretty much had a consensus that Franklin's density estimate was a little too generous. Statisticians today, they would call his conditions mosh pit conditions. And there's no reason to think that was really a good average value based on the subjective descriptions of the revival crowds.
Braxton settled on a density of 2 people per square meter, a little roomier than Ben's estimate. And after a little number crunching, he has his own number for Whitfield's crowd size.
Under the most optimistic acoustic conditions, probably, he may have been able to speak to about 50,000 people.
And there you have it. Old Ben wasn't too far off. He guessed that a crowd of 30,000 people could have heard George Whitfield speak. Braxton found that on a perfect day, 50,000 people probably could have heard him, making 30,000 a pretty reasonable figure. So could we do this with other famous orators? Estimate crowd sizes for Patrick Henry or even Caesar? Braxton says it might just be possible.
We could analyze the geometry of their spaces and have some idea whether the reported crowds for them were also reasonable.
We're going to assign you to go to Gettysburg next.
That is on my list.